says, please don't revive. I would paint all over it, but I'm afraid of heights. There's plenty of those old tapes playing around inside my head. I'm welcome in the future.
Warradu.
You're listening to WONY 90.9 FM on Yanta.
Warradu.
It's all just inside jokes.
Warradu.
That should be one.
What's one of your favorite memories?
Let's see. Well, there was this one time I went snorkeling in the Caribbean when I was a kid. It really just blew my mind. I mean, when you're sitting on the beach, it's so peaceful, and you sort of forget there's a whole other world under there, just full of all kinds of life. We saw the most beautiful corals. I remember thinking they were waving at us as they moved with the ocean. And then there were all these amazing fish. They kind of reminded me of tropical birds. They were so bright and colorful, just darting all over the place like birds in the sky. I'll never forget it. It completely changed the way I look at the ocean.
Most of us have a memory of being in nature we'll never forget. Let's protect the world's natural places so more memories can be made for generations to come. Visit worldwildlife.org.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the WONY Weekly Update. Here are some things to look forward to. On Tuesday, September 30th, join the Ultimate Frisbee Team for their practice happening from 4 to 6 p.m. on the intramural field. Also happening on Tuesday, join the Computer Art Club for their meeting happening in Fine Arts 321 from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Lastly, join Student Association for Trivia Tuesday happening from 9 to 10 p.m. in the Red Dragon Theater. On Thursday, join the Student Caribbean Association for a game of Spooky Bingo happening from 6 to 7 p.m. in Alumni Hall. Also happening on Thursday, join the Center for Racial Justice for a powerful panel discussion in celebration of Hispanic and Latinx Heritage Month. This will be happening in the Great Room from 6:30 to 8 p.m. On Friday, join OK Crew for their K-pop dance workshop happening from 4 to 5 p.m. in Fine Arts 103. On Saturday, be sure to check out the community table at the Farmers Market. This will be happening on Dietz Street in town from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. On Saturday, join Student Association for A Night of the Impossible with Larry and Raven. This will be happening from 8 to 9 p.m. in the ballroom. On Sunday, join WONY for our general body meeting and come and learn about our awesome club. This will be happening from 3 to 4 p.m. in Fitzell Hall 303. Hope to see you there. This has been your WONY Weekly Update on WONY 90.9 FM Oneonta. Be sure to have a great week and keep it locked.
Hola, Oneonta, DJ Nosfer, Mark II. That's right. What's in your pocket? This is a special edition today. I'm super excited. An old student and friend, Brian Kenneth Miller. I like the middle name always thrown in there on the things. I guess Brian Miller's a pretty common name.
It is. It's like there's 5,000 of us in America alone.
Yes, that's right. Is here to talk with us for the hour. And before then, Brian was in one of a couple semesters, I believe, of the rock ensemble. And one thing that always sticks in my brain is how much he loved the Van Halen. So and somewhat of that 80s guitar shreddy kind of stuff. So we're going to start off with a little bit of Van Halen, then we'll be back and kind of be blabbing about tons of stuff and see what he's doing up here this weekend. We got some little guitars going on.
Thank you.
Yo, we back. Yo, we back. Cool. So that was Little Guitars, Van Halen off of Diver Down, which is an absolutely great album. Those first six Van Halen albums are great. We are here, though, for the special edition of What's in Your Pocket with Brian Miller, graduate 2010?
Yep.
2010. Yep. Okay, so let's backtrack a little bit here. I want to do a little... how'd you get here, and a little bit of your schooling and so forth, yeah. Right? So prior to, I guess you would have come here in 2007.
Did 2006, you, were you four, yeah.
Four-year, five-year?
Yeah, 2006.
Okay,
yeah.
2006. So what made you come to SUNY Oneonta? What did you do while you were here? Yeah. Let's talk about that first.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was dead set on being a rock star. So yep. I, in high school, I spent the last... entire year, my senior year of high school, studying with a private instructor in order to be able to apply and audition for Berklee College of Music. It was my dream to go to Berklee. And if you're familiar with Berklee or if you're not, it's the number one contemporary music school maybe in the world, certainly in North America. Yep. If you want to go for rock and pop, you know, you go to Berklee. And the old joke about Berklee is if you graduate from Berklee, you'll never make it in the music industry. That's because true. Everybody, Melissa Etheridge Satriani, did he go there? No.
Did Vi go?
Yeah, it's one of them went there. All the guys from... Dream Theater met while they were there, but they all left in the middle to become famous, right? To get signed. And so it was my dream to go to Berklee, and I spent a year auditioning or practicing, drove from Buffalo, where I'm from, all the way to Boston and to do the audition. Did the audition, waited a few months, got my letter in the mail, and out of 2,000 guitarists that applied, only 100 were being accepted, and I got in.
Yay!
So... I was like, well, this is it. I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to Berklee. Yeah. And then my dad put the second piece of paper in front of me that had the number on it.
That's where they get you at the Berklee, right?
The price tag, even then, and this was almost, this was literally 20 years ago, the price tag was $52,000 a year. It's like $65,000 or something now. I mean, it's absurd. A year, right?
Yeah.
And so my dad said, listen, I've been putting away for your college for your entire life. I've put away a decent amount of money. I've done my part as a parent. He put that number in front of me. He goes, as you can see, this will not even come close to covering your time at Berklee. You're welcome to all of it. It's yours. But after that, it's on you. I've done my job. And I did the math even at 17 years old. And I went, well, if I go $200,000 in debt and come out with a degree in electric rock guitar, I'm probably screwed for life, right? So I was like,
"It'll be cool, though."
It would be cool. I have friends who actually did go to Berklee, sure. And they're like, "It's not as cool as it seems. You're mostly just reading sheet music for 4 years." So I started looking for other schools, and when I found SUCO, there's the music industry program, but more importantly, there's like a recording studio on campus, like a full-fledged, and it's so rare for there to be a state school at state school prices with a recording studio on campus where you can actually learn how to do that. And I was do you remember those Boss all-in-one four-track recorders with the little mini discs or with a tape?
Pepperidge Farm remembers. That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah, they had
I had recorded dozens of awful, awful songs that I had written that I thought were excellent, at home. And so I was like, this is cool. So I decided to come to SUCO for music industry audio engineering. And that's what I did the entirety of my freshman year, which is how we met, because I was in the I had three different versions of the same band over the course of the couple of years I was here. But the first version of it was formed in the very first semester in the rock ensemble.
It's called Rock Combo, I think.
Rock Combo, that's
that
right.
Point. It's called the Rock Ensemble now, but
yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah, so like I was basically the group of guys that you randomly paired me with, I ended up for the most part, staying with, I think we changed bass players every year for some reason. But, like, other than that, we just, like, stuck together.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And but by the end of my freshman year, it was 2006, if you remember, that is the year the music industry went bankrupt. The entire bottom fell out of the music industry.
It had
it was a slow decline and then a fast decline. And I was looking at that going, I don't think there's going to be a job for me on the other side of this if I stick with the music business. And so I pivoted from there sophomore year into I switched into secondary education math, like into being a high school math teacher. I thought, well, there at least there's going to be a job for that.
Yep.
So that was the next year. Yeah, it was secondary ed math. which was interesting because I didn't really like math, but I was good at it because my parents are both computer scientists. Okay, I just have the math gene, and I thought, well, I would like teaching, so like that's a option, you know. I can still try to be a rock star kind of thing on the side, you know, that kind of thing, you know.
Yep.
But I hated the ed classes. I was just bored by them. I loved my teachers, but I hated the classes. I was bored. And so at the end of my sophomore year, I dropped the ed major because I was bored of it. And then over that summer, had a complete existential crisis because I realized I was about to go into my junior year of college and I was only a math major. And as previously stated, I don't like math.
Yep.
So I was like, what am I going to do? I can't just be a math major. I'm not going to be a mathematician. So I picked up the philosophy degree as a dual major because I was oh yeah, that one philosophy class I took one time was interesting. I thought philosophy was like, we're just going to talk about the Matrix, right? Like that's what philosophy
sure,
is.
Sure, right.
And it turns out it was partly we're just going to talk about the Matrix. it was stuff like that, and I ended up finishing my dual bachelor's of science in mathematics and philosophy, and never used either of them.
Amazing. I took a bunch of philosophy classes when I was in college as well. I got an ed degree.
Hey, yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to be a rock star too, you know. So
sure.
But so I got a music ed degree, so that the same thing, so that I knew, hey, when I got out, at least I could teach when I fail as a rock star, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But with that ed degree, you had to take a lot of philosophy of education. I had to take like 3 or 4 philosophy classes.
Yep.
Which I really enjoyed, and I know you were up here talking, we'll get to this in a minute, but I was always... The same thing when I was in school were like people like, oh man, you're going to get one of these degrees in like sociology or philosophy, which you're going to get out of school and be like, the only thing you can do with it is get a doctorate and then teach at a college
and
university.
Then teach it, right.
You know, because what else are you going to do with the thing? So with that being said, let's take a look. So you get through, and I remember you, I always thought it was totally intriguing because in school, like, you know, you're getting these degrees in something. You're a really great guitar player, so you're doing this thing, but then you're not getting a degree in that. And then you're like, oh, I'm a magician. And I was like, okay, what's up with this dude? Like, this dude, okay, great, awesome. He's going to be a magician. Cool. Which is awesome, but just something... there are maybe 3 people in my entire life that I have met that are magicians.
Yeah. Right?
And they're a special breed of people. in a good way, they're all amazing, but they're just these totally intriguing characters who are, like, good at it, right?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people, like, hey, you know, you get little, like, you know, whatever. I got this little magician kit, you know, or something like
my
that.
My kid just turned 5 last week. He got his first magic kit.
Yeah, and you're kind of like, I think everybody at some point in their life gets one, you know, between the age of 0 and 10 or something.
Yep.
And you're like, cool, it's a little sliding box with some coin that disappears.
Yeah, that's right.
Kind of like, cool. And then it just kind of, after a week, goes by the wayside.
And
you know, you forget about it and parts get missing and... You know,
you show the 3 tricks you have to the 5 people you know 25 times, and that's it.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, the backyard birthday party thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, with that being said, like, this is a side quest for you, right? And then you graduate from SUNY Oneonta in 2010 with this dual major in philosophy and math. And as a kind of shredder guitar player who knows how to play magic, or no, not play magic. Play magic, as you call it.
I don't play magic.
We do the magic. I don't play magic. You know.
I did once. I couldn't get into it. I couldn't. There's too many rules.
Yeah, I'm not into the gathering part. Okay, so 2010, that happens. What goes on with Brian Miller at this point?
Yeah, so I mean, so it's funny you described it as a side quest because it was interesting because magic is actually the thing that's been in my life the longest by far. So I was introduced to magic by my dad and my grandfather when I was very, very little, 4, 5, 6 years old. I got my first magic kicks just like my kid just got his, roughly the same age that I got mine. Not a coincidence. And my dad was an excellent amateur magician. My grandfather, his dad, was an excellent amateur magician. Neither of them ever did it professionally, but my dad was always doing magic tricks for me and my friends at the house. He would come into my school and do magic shows when I was in elementary school. Like, he was a properly good magician, not a sleight of hand artist, but like he had the props and the gizmos and the stuff out of the magic shops, but he was a great performer. I mean, he's a distinguished teaching professor at SUNY Buffalo. He's a magnificent teacher, and so he's just like a great performer. And so I was around magic all my life, went to magic shows all the time, got magic tricks for every birthday. I mean, it was a big part of my life. It's just that nobody could have ever imagined how seriously I would end up taking it. So what happened was I was doing magic tricks like by myself in my room for like most of my life. But I, as a kid, had a severe speech and social anxiety, which you would never know now, right?
No, of course.
But I couldn't talk to anybody, no confidence, no friends, bullied, real classic Disney Channel bullied, you know, smashed into lockers, book knocks out of your hand, you know, that kind of thing. Got beat up real good in middle school and decided I was going to switch to a different district essentially for high school, just start over, kids who don't know me. And in ninth grade, I'm a freshman in high school. I'm at a lunch table. There's these other kids sitting at the end of the table. I'm not sitting with them. I don't even think they notice I'm at the table, you know, kind of thing. And I had a pack of cards in my pocket, and I had been working on this trick recently, but I had never shown a magic trick to anybody in my life. Like, I just did them for me in my room. And magic is interesting. It's the only art form you can't do for your own enjoyment.
That's right.
Right, you can't because you know how all the tricks work.
That's right.
You, like today, I play guitar. I play guitar every day when I'm at home. But like, I just close the door. I can play for hours for my own enjoyment.
That's right.
Totally fulfilled. No one hears it, and it's fine. You can write for your own enjoyment, poetry, all these things. But magic, you know the tricks. You literally can't see the magic.
Yeah.
So this day, I'm sitting at this lunch table, and I don't know what came over me. I pulled the pack of cards out, turned to these kids, and said, "Do you want to see a card trick?" And they literally jumped. Like, I think I appeared at the table at that moment. And my hands were shaking physically, but I managed to get through a trick, and it was like they flipped out. Like, they jumped up and started screaming and started calling other kids over, like, hey, show them what you just showed us. And I, like, became Magic Kid overnight. And I became popular, and I started getting invited to parties. And as long as I had my pockets full of magic, as long as I was willing to be Magic Monkey on command, which I was totally willing to be, I was popular. And through learning magic, I developed like self-confidence and interpersonal skills. And because I could hide behind the tricks a little bit, and I started to learn how to be funny and quirky and interesting. And so at 16, I got my official, I founded a business like legally in Buffalo. I had a doing business as Brian Miller Magic and started doing paid gigs at 16. And so I was, you know, doing paid magic gigs all the way through college. So what you professors like didn't see is that I wrote my papers in hotel rooms most through college, because on nights and weekends I was traveling all around New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. I was with printed MapQuest directions, somehow getting around the Northeast, never getting lost. Now I get lost with my GPS on. I don't know.
No, I do remember. It's funny because I remember there's parts of your brain that can remember things and, you know, that are tucked in behind some things. But I remember sometimes every once in a while you being like, oh, well, I have this magic gig. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
That's right. Like, he's not doing that. He's doing something else. Like,
yeah. You know, like, yeah, no, legitimately.
That's
yeah.
Real.
Yeah. I would drive like 2 or 3 hours and do, you know, a couple of hours of close-up magic at some company holiday party in the boondocks of New York. And then
incredible.
You stay in a hotel, write my paper, and drive back for class the next morning. And I did that all the way through college. And so right before I graduated, I had been accepted into some doctorate programs, some PhD programs for philosophy. My plan was to follow my dad into academia and go be a philosophy professor. And at the last second, I was April of 2010, like a month before graduating, I was on this tour of, I was doing magic at comedy clubs and colleges all over New York State. And the shows were going so well. I was having so much fun. And just a month before graduating, I went, I got to find out if I can make it as a magician. Like, I'll always wonder. Like, I don't want to go to my deathbed and wonder if I could have made it, because nobody gets to make it doing this. Like, it's just so hard.
Yep.
And so I turned down the grad school offers, the PhD offers, and decided I'm going to try to make it as a magician. Okay. And that was it.
It's like the, you know, if you told him once, you told him twice, Spinal Tap above the puppet show. That's
oh, man.
That's incredible. So you go and do that, right?
I went and did it. I did the starving artist thing. It did not work for a while. I thought, you know, when you're, you know, it's like the blissful, you know, ignorance of youth, man. I thought, oh, I'm great at this. I already have gotten paid to do it lots of times. I'm just going to go conquer and be the greatest magician.
And you're living at home at this point? Did you go back home?
No. Okay, so that's interesting. It's interesting you asked that. I didn't go back home at this point. My dad's still in Buffalo. My mom's in Baltimore. Both of them said, come live with me, okay. Right? You know, like, I come from, you know, a middle to upper middle class, you know, families. So like, by no means was I ever like, this is a part of my story I always feel like I need to caveat for people. I got to screw around with trying to be a professional magician because I came from a family where I was never going to be homeless. I was never going to be not able to feed myself. And it does matter, right?
It does.
Like, at no point was I going to be unable to feed myself. But what the problem with that, there's a double-edged sword. The problem with that is a lot in situations like that, you don't have a lot of motivation to make it either, because you know that you're going to be fine no matter what.
Yep.
And so I was really aware of that. And so I didn't want to go home because I didn't want the safety net of living at home, having my parents pay for food my dad was like, I'll set you up in an apartment. I'll help you get it furnished. He was ready to just like support me fully to try the magic thing. But I didn't want that support because I was worried that I wouldn't make it if I had that support, that I just wouldn't work hard enough or have any motivation. So I moved to Connecticut, where my aunt and uncle and cousins were, and they said, you can come crash with us or live with us for a while if you want, because they knew I was trying to figure out what to do. And so I went to them in Connecticut, lived with them for about 3 months, and then immediately co-signed a lease with a former college buddy. And we started renting an $800 a month tiny little apartment where we were each responsible for $400 a month. And at the time, I had one magic gig. It was a recurring Saturday night at a restaurant. They paid me $100 a week, once a week on a Saturday.
Well,
so let's do the math.
Right?
So I was paying my rent, and that was it. I literally didn't have the money to eat. And my parents make their own decisions. I'm a parent now. You make your own decision. Both of them decided, well, if you're going to go off and not come home, like, we're not going to support you, like, financially. Like, if you're going to go do this, then go do it.
Yeah, 100%.
And so,
yeah.
So I didn't take a penny after that point from either of them, which is not to say I didn't have their support my whole life until that point. But after that point, I didn't take a penny. And so I had to figure out how to pay my rent, feed myself, fill my tank, you know, with the money I was making as a magician. And about a year into it, I had dropped 20 pounds from what I currently am. Like I was like I'm a fairly skinny dude, I would say, on the radio. I'm 6 feet tall. I'm like 152 pounds when I'm like eating nice and healthy. Like I'm just a fairly skinny dude.
Yep.
I was like 129 pounds. It was not good.
Don't turn sideways, right?
Yeah, I was very sick. I was exhausted. I was burnt out. And I was ready to throw in the towel. I reapplied to grad school. So I was ready to go, this isn't working. And then just a little lucky break here. Little extra gig there that led to some more things. And before that next round of grad school letters came back in, I again decided to turn down going back to grad school and keep trying it, and started to get some success. And
this is like 2012?
Yeah, maybe? so right around 2012 is when things started to really turn up. So for the better part of the first 2 years after college, I was really barely making it. I would find one private event that would pay me $300 once a month, and that would get me food, gas. Like, it was just able to just scrape by. In 2012, I started finding some success actually in the college market as a comedy magician. Doing enough, and those gigs paid a lot better. College gigs pay pretty well.
Yeah, of course.
And I started doing some local corporate. I was doing more restaurants at that time. So if I was doing magic in two or three restaurants a week, and I would hand out my business card at every table when I was done, a lot of those people owned small businesses, and so they might have a company holiday party, and they would bring me, or maybe a Sweet 16 for their kid who saw me at Applebee's doing magic, and they would bring me to the private event. So I started to get some momentum in 2012, and then it was like, okay, I'm making enough money to actually go, okay, like I can like live a decent life. And from there, I started to go, well, what would this career look like if it, like, what would the next level look like? And I started building, and eventually, toured the world. It was
cool.
It was wild.
That's amazing. So we're going to take a quick, we're going to listen to a song, and then we'll come back and get the second half of this of this tale here. I brought some albums in, and not a ton, but I tried to bring some cool old harder edge stuff in here, and we're going to listen to some Children of the Grave. I started early. I'm going to put some Embryo in there first because it plays right before it.
Yeah, 8:30 in the morning.
You know, you got it. That's 8:30 in the morning. Anyways, here's some Sabbath for y'all out there in Radioland. Well, there it was. There's some Children of the Grave. We were talking about Youngblood in between there. Just because I know a lot of people have seen Youngblood recently. So interesting. I'm going to have to check out the new album. What is the name of the new album? Do you know the
name? Is it called Idols? I think it might be called Idols.
Okay, I'm going to have to check
it out. But I could be wrong about that.
But more importantly, we're going to get back because we got about 20 minutes. So what I want to do is kind of, it is 2012 or so, and you are starting to get some money coming in as a magician. And I want to talk about how you got from there to... You're sitting here today in the morning because you're doing a bunch of cool stuff at SUNY today, and you're all over the world and stuff like that. What happens next in the life of Brian Kenneth Miller?
Yeah, so here's the short of it. So I start to make it as a magician between like 2013 and 2015. My career really, really explodes. I the way I used to describe it, I get about as successful as you can be without being famous as a magician. So like no one's ever heard of me, but you would have no idea like how well I'm making it kind of a thing, you know? Okay. So it's a good life and I'm enjoying myself. I'm traveling around, doing high end corporate exclusive event entertainment. I get recognized a couple of times as one of America's best small venue performers in the college market. It's going well. In 2015, I'm invited to give a talk at a local TEDx conference held at a high school in Connecticut. Now, if you're familiar with TED Talks these days, they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous, right? TED Talks, the red dots that everybody, you know, gets on. Now, the thing is, back when I was invited to do this, the TEDx program was fairly young. TEDx was when TED, the big fancy ones with all the famous speakers, TED decided to start licensing their style of event to local communities. So local communities could hold a TED style event, and these were called TEDx events. So you still have to abide by all the TED guidelines and blah, blah, blah. But otherwise, the communities were left to their own devices, and it was to amplify local voices, the kind of voices who don't have big global platforms. So a high school teacher at a local high school in Connecticut, where I was living, decides he applies for and gets a license to host one of these. He's going to have some students speak, some local professionals speak, and he gets my name through the Connecticut grapevine because he's looking for somebody a little more like interesting, and asks if I'd like to talk at this conference. And I was like, I've been watching TED Talks since, you know, the YouTube existed. Like, I'm like, oh my God, like, yes. And he said, well, what do you think you might want to talk about? Now, what's interesting about that is that today in 2025, people will spend years of their life pursuing a TED Talk. They will spend years, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, hiring coaches and consultants and professionals to help them get onto a TEDx stage and deliver like the talk of their life. You have to know today what you're going to talk about. You have to pitch it to organizers. You have to be locked down in your message.
Yeah.
This was the Wild West in 2015 in the world of TEDx. He said, hey, I've heard you're interesting. Would you like to speak? Having no idea what I would talk about or if I'd be any good. Awesome. I said, sure. And he goes, what do you think you would want to talk about? I was just left to just invent what I would like to talk about. And I didn't want to give a TEDx talk about magic. Like, he wanted me to be to talk about my magic career, but I didn't really want to talk about magic because the thing is, I had heard a few TED Talks by magicians, and they were things like the art of misdirection, the beauty of wonder, the morality of deception. And I was like, these are things magicians care about. Like, this is stuff that magicians talk about at 2 a.m. after a magic convention. Like, it's nerdy magic stuff.
Yep.
But I was like, normal people don't care about this. Like, what would normal people care about that I can offer as a magician? And I realized that something magicians do better than most is make instant connections with strangers. It's the job. And I thought, well, it'd be interesting if I could give a talk about how magicians do that and show people how you can use the same technique in your life to make quick, meaningful connections with strangers. And I cared about that because, as previously noted, I had been bullied and friendless for a lot of my life. I didn't know how to connect with people. Then I had developed a real ego as a magician and got really full of myself and then turned people off for a different reason, right? And so I'd struggled to connect with people until I figured this out. And it had changed my life. I had, you know, met the, you know, my a girlfriend who was now a fiance, now my wife today, you know, and I had amazing friends and my career had exploded. And so I was like, this technique of learning how to make really good connections with people matters. It changed my life. And I wanted to talk about that. So I gave my TEDx talk called How to Magically Connect with Anyone. And I thought really nothing of it. I did my best and hoped it would get seen by 1,000 people. That was like the pipe dream.
Yep.
Because this was a high school conference run by 15-year-olds. Like, and it looked like it was run by 15-year-olds. And when that video hit YouTube in June of 2015, it went viral. It got seen by millions of people, like 3.5 million people around the world. And today, that doesn't sound like big numbers on the internet because we're so used to big numbers in 2025. In 2015, it was impossible. I got literally recognized in airports. Like, people would stop me and go, "My God, did you give a TED Talk?" Like, it changed my life overnight. I started getting invited all over the world by companies who had seen my TED Talk to come talk about human connection for, like, corporate culture, team building, stuff like this. And it was bananas because I was like, I am not an expert in this topic. Like, I had 14 minutes and 12 seconds to say about that, and I said it in my TED Talk. But the money they were offering me to come give these major corporate speeches was so absurd, and I was engaged to get married. I had a wedding coming up. It's like, I got to say yes.
Of course.
I got to figure this out. And so I basically leveraged my imposter syndrome to study everything I could possibly study just because I didn't want to look like an idiot doing these speaking gigs, and kind of accidentally studied myself into being the quote unquote expert in human connection. To this day, if you Google human connection speakers anywhere in the world, I come up first.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
I mean, the AI results, like, that are now out there. So I started I shifted out of magic over the next few years into speaking. And the way that I got here, to your point, like present day, why am I back on campus giving a talk last night here is because eventually, I was so successful as a speaker, people started reaching out asking if I could teach them how to be as good a speaker as I was. It was a meta question. They were like, I don't want to learn how to talk about what you talk about. I don't even want to learn about the content of what you're talking about. I want to learn how you speak and design speeches and give presentations that are so engaging and so... And so I, you know, shrug. I don't know. I've never taught anybody how to be a speaker before, but I'm a big fan of say yes, figure it out later, you know?
Yeah.
And so I started teaching people people who are experts in their topic, how to translate that into a great, engaging speech for non-experts. And that took off and exploded, and I eventually founded a consulting firm, and that's what we do. So my primary job now, even though I maintain my speaking career by day, my primary job is I'm the founder and principal consultant at a message design firm for experts. So we teach smart people how to explain their ideas to the rest of us.
So what? You know, if you had said that to, you know, the 17-year-old who was going to go to Berkeley to be a rock star, this is what you're going to be doing in the future, you know, would probably be like, what?
None of that would have made sense. I would have had no idea what any of it meant. I mean, because, like, I didn't know that was possible. I mean, we also kind of invented, like, what we do, right? It would have been impossible. The way I would have had to describe it to 17-year-old me is I would have said, imagine that there's a day when any guitar that you're dreaming about, you can buy if you want to. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. It was like, that's how I would have had to describe it.
Yeah, right?
Like, I got really stupid at one point
and
about buying guitars.
Playing music.
Yeah. I got really, like, at some point, I actually finally decided to enjoy the success. And the way that I enjoy it, some people they buy a fancy car or they fly first class. I don't do any of those things. I'm driving a 10-year-old Hyundai that I've paid off.
Sure.
I fly in the back of the plane with everybody else. What I did was I owned 14 guitars.
Yeah, that's way more guitars than I own, and that's my actual profession.
For me, it was like, one, I won't buy a guitar that I don't play, though. I don't buy them to look at them. I will only buy a guitar that I play. But they happen to also be art. So it's like I love walking into my home studio and being surrounded by beautiful guitars and having a choice, you know, of being like, do I feel like playing a Strat today? Do I feel like shredding today? Do I feel like playing a Les Paul today? You know, so that's the thing that's the life enjoyment that I've gotten out of this.
Yeah. How many Washburns do you own?
Yeah, none.
Oh, really? You have none?
No Washburns. I don't have an N4.
That's daunting.
I know. Yeah, you know, here's the problem. Here's why I don't own an N4. You know how many times it's been in my cart?
I can only imagine.
The reason is I have a PV Wolfgang. I have a Jackson Shred, the same Jackson I still own that I played when I was here.
Is that a soloist? Was it?
It's a Japanese. It's a 1993 Japanese made Jackson. It's a weird
pro soloist.
Yeah, it's one of those. But I've changed everything in it a million times.
Okay,
nothing original in there anymore. I had a body cavity cut out larger so I could put an original Floyd Rose in there, like all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
It's currently got the PAF Fred and Pro pickups, the ones Satch was using in the 80s that have that kind of open vowel sound.
Yeah.
It's great. I love that sound. But, you know, I have an original PV Wolfgang. I have a Schecter. Like, what are you going to do with one more double humbucking shred monster? Like, I have enough of those.
Be awesome.
You know? So at some point I started actually going, well, what are the kind of guitars I always didn't like or didn't think were for me? It was like, you know, like a Strat. Like, I was always I never liked Fenders. Like a Tele. So I have a G&L ASAT.
They're
now
awesome guitars,
oh my God,
by the way.
I have an American made, like, out of Fullerton, and it's one of my favorite guitars. Like, I'll pick it up more often than almost any guitar now. I became a Tele guy. But like those, the G&L pickups though, those hot pickups, man, they're something else. I have a Fender Strat now. I was one of those guys. I'm like, I hate where the volume knob is. I hate
That's
the middle
right.
pickup. And, but I was gonna get a Strat. So you'll like this. I was in the market for a Strat. I'm like, I'm gonna buy a Strat. I'm gonna learn a Strat. I'm gonna learn how to play a Strat. Like who cares? Right? I'm just playing for me now. And so I was looking at like the S style guitars, Strat style. I was looking at the Schecter, like Nick Johnston versions, and I was looking at the whatever. And my buddy, who's a professional musician and owns a music academy up in Connecticut, I'm telling him about all the different Strat styles that I'm looking at. And he literally, can we curse on here?
We can't curse. No, we cannot curse.
We cannot curse. All right. So I'll bleep this. So he goes, if you're gonna get a Strat, just buy a Strat. Like, so I was like, all right, fair enough. So I bought a Fender Strat and learned that.
An American one? Did you get an American one? Or did you get
no. I you know what? I got a Player Series and then swapped the pickups and had the neck worked on. You know, and I put the custom shop Fat 50s in there, and they're unbelievable. And then I had the neck edges rolled a little bit, so it feels a little bit better. I was playing the American ones, and I'm playing the Player Series, and they didn't feel any
no, they don't.
Better. They felt different, but they didn't feel better. And I couldn't justify the extra $1,000.
You know, it's interesting. I have, I'm not a Strat guy at all, but after Orlando's passing, and Orlando was here when you were here.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
As we were cleaning up certain parts of the building and stuff like that, just whatever, this was not that long ago, actually. This was probably about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. He had a black Squire 2 that he had turned into a MIDI guitar.
Oh my God.
So he had all these crazy MIDI pickups. Like, this is back before whatever. This is like when it first started coming out, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, he had this big contraption on it, whatever, you know. And we found it in a storage closet, and I took it, and I have been over the past few years just taking parts off it and putting it back on to clean it up and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I have that in my office, and I play it quite frequently, actually, just during lessons and stuff like that, just because I'm just channeling Orlando, who is awesome. That thing plays, the neck on it is amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't really, a lot of times with those kinds of things, and you know, like,
yeah.
Okay, the body and the neck, does it feel good?
Yeah.
Do my hands like it? Okay, everything else is replaceable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You could just take everything off, right, and just put in whatever you want on those things.
Well, it's funny about guitar, right? That's why you can watch a million You can watch all the blind tests, right? Like Anderton's on YouTube. They do a great job of all these blind shootouts. And yep. And the problem with the blind shootouts is you can listen to a Squire and listen to a custom shop Fender. And if you've got your eyes closed and you don't know which one you're listening to, a lot of times you can't tell the difference. You can't hear it once it's going through the amp and the pet, you know, whatever.
Sure.
You can't hear what they're missing in the blind shootouts. They'll use that to go, look it, you don't have to spend all this money on guitar. You can get the cheap one. What they're missing is the way it feels to play the guitar.
That's right.
And if it doesn't feel good, right? If it doesn't feel good, you will play differently, right? And so it's like if I'm playing a guitar with really pokey frets and a sharp fretboard, I'm not going to play with the same feel as I would a nice rolled fretboard and whatever. And so even if it sounds the same, I won't play the same, and that matters. So
100%. I tell all my students, I say, you know, you can get a good guitar between $500 and $1,000.
Totally.
You could, especially these days.
Oh my God, these days, like $500 today, what that buys you in a guitar. Can you think about the kind of guitar I could afford? Like what a $500 got me when I was, oh my God.
Yeah. So, you know, $500 guitar, you just go out and I tell everybody, sit down with the guitar. Does it fit with your body shape? Does it fit with your hand size? Does it feel good when you're playing it? Because literally, if it's a solid body,
yeah,
the tone is going to come from the pickups and the amp and totally. The height of the strings and that kind of stuff. The hands have something to do with it. But, you know, the concept is if you just hit the guitar without, you know, fretting anything, that's the tone the guitar is going to get with the signal chain.
So you just need
to make sure it feels good, and then you can alter whatever you want from there.
Yeah. So not to mention the most boring part of the whole signal chain that no one ever talks about. You know what I discovered, and it's so depressing because it's not fun or sexy, and so nobody talks about it. You know the most important part of your tone, the thing that makes the biggest, most drastic difference? It's the speakers in the cabinet. Swap the speakers. Put different speakers in there. The entire thing changes dramatically. And you just go, but it's not fun to talk about speakers or buy speakers. So we talk about the... It's way more fun to buy pedals, man.
It is. It's funny. I have somebody built my amp for me. I have like a custom... it's kind of like a modified Princeton.
Nice.
It's super awesome. It's 9 watts. It's just a very small enclosure, and there was a Celestian in there, and I put a Patriot in there, and it sounds better.
But it sounds different.
It sounds totally different. I'm just like, man, this thing sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Well, tell us where, because we got to wrap this up in a minute, but tell us, number one, what your website is for your business.
Sure. ClarityUpConsulting.com.
Amazing.
But if you just Google Brian Miller, you'll find me anywhere.
Okay, sweet. And then what is going on today in Oneonta? So that's always a good thing to know, too.
Yeah. So the reason I'm in town, ostensibly, is tonight is TEDx Oneonta. So a lot of people don't know. Oneonta has every year their own TED style event, officially licensed.
That's right.
They've got speakers coming in. Some are local, some are flying in from as far away as Utah to give their 10-minute talk tonight. It's amazing. 7 o'clock, I think, is the actual start, but 5 o'clock starts cocktail hour hors d'oeuvres. I believe I have no official affiliation with this conference. I'm here to support a client, but I believe it's $25 to buy a ticket, and that gets you the whole cocktail hour, the whole conference. Listen to speakers, diverse perspectives, meet them afterwards. It's awesome, and I'll be there.
Great. Fantastic. It's always good to see you, Brian Miller.
Absolutely.
When's the last time you were here? Last time we were at the diner, I remember. I think about
2 years ago.
Yeah, he always flies. He comes in from time to time. The school is very proud of what you've done, which is awesome. And we like to, you know, keep our alumni engaged too, and bring you up here. So,
thanks for doing this. This is fun. It's fun to catch up.
Always good time. Going to leave you with some Living Color Cult of Personality because this is an awesome song. I saw them on Jimmy Kimmel last night, killing it. Yeah. So we're gonna play this for you. Everybody, have a great day. This is. DJ Nas from Mark II, What's in Your Pocket, keeping it locked, 90.9 FM, home of Red Dragon Radio, basement of Hunt Union, Wony rockin'.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Hey, kitty, I'm home. Do you want some dinner? Okay, okay. Here you go. Okay, so you don't want dinner. What do you want? Treats? Catnip? Dude, I don't know what you want. I'm just going to turn on the radio.
You're listening to WONY 90.9 FM Oneonta.
That's what you wanted? I guess I'll have to tune in more often.
I'm pregnant. I'm supposed to be happy.
I haven't been myself since the baby was born.
What's wrong with me?
I should be happy, but I'm sad.
Will these feelings ever go away?
Being pregnant and having a baby can be a wonderful experience, but sometimes it can make you feel sad, anxious, or constantly worried about being a